Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
If your activity's been down, the last quarter's a good time to bring it up, because that's when your evaluation's going to be done. And we all know this job is, what have you done for me lately?
Policing by the numbers, and what have you done for me lately? That was a tape excerpt from a roll call at the 81st Precinct in Bedford-Stuyvesant. NYPD officer Adrian Schoolcraft secretly recorded hundreds of hours of audio, everything from roll calls to water cooler banter. And those recordings seem to reveal pretty damning police practices. Captains pressuring officers to both keep major crime numbers down by downgrading crimes while keeping arrests and minor citations up. And it all calls into question whether we should believe the reports that crime is actually down in the city. Schoolcraft released the tapes exclusively to the Village Voice, and they are running their story at the Voice in a three-part series. They published the first two parts already, which many of you may have read. Village Voice investigative reporter and author of the series, Graham Raymond, joins us now with more excerpts and with thoughts about what it all means. Graham, welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you very much.
So before we hear any more clips or open the phones, and we definitely will be curious to hear from other police officers who may happen to be listening today, and officers, get ready to call in. You can definitely call anonymously on this if you'd like. But Schoolcraft made these recordings between June 2008 and October of 2009. Why did he make them in the first place?
Well, he told me that initially he did it to protect himself from street encounters, from civilian complaints, basically, in street encounters. And then there was a certain point where his views of how the precinct was being run changed, and he started to record because there were things that he didn't agree with or things that – and then finally he recorded because he thought that after he had started raising issues within the precinct to his superiors, he recorded because he thought that they were retaliating against him.
And is he currently an officer on the NYPD, but his name – is in your paper and everything?
His status is very – he's in some kind of employment limbo. I'm not really sure exactly whether he's suspended or what, but he is still technically a police officer.
He's in the police equivalent of the rubber room?
Something like
while
that.
Because he released all these tapes?
No. It goes back to what happened on October 31st of 2009. He went home sick from work. The short version is he went home sick from work. A few hours later, a number of police supervisors arrived. They ordered him to go back to work. He refused. Then he was classified EDP, which means someone with psychological issues, and they forcibly took him to the Jamaica Hospital psychiatric ward.
Now, the tapes reveal this catch-22 for cops. They're being pressured to both keep the major crime numbers down while keeping their arrest and citation activity and also, I gather, stop and frisk activity up. Explain these two opposing forces.
Well, it basically comes from CompStat, which is the department's program to hold commanding officers accountable for what's happening in their precinct. And it's all statistics based. So, and every officer is held accountable for the number of arrests, the number of tickets they write, the number of stop and frisk they do, and the number of community visits, which means you go and talk to a business owner about how things are going. And those numbers are very carefully taken. They're reviewed at the precinct level, they're reviewed by the borough commanders, and then they're reviewed at police headquarters. So there's a pressure to hit these numbers every month. And then on the other side of it, there was an air of skepticism in the precinct about crime complaints, and the officers were repeatedly told, you know, be skeptical about crime complaints, and there was even a policy which said that if the crime victim did not want to immediately return to the station house to talk to detectives, that no complaint should be taken.
Let's play another clip. And police officers, we want to hear from you. Is this how it works? Village Voice reporter Graham Raymond not a police officer, ever been a police officer?
No.
So he's acting as a journalist. He's getting information from police officers and from these tapes, and we'll play another excerpt in a minute. But police officers, if you happen to be listening today, is this actually how it works? And has it started to work like this more over time? I mean, CompStat goes all the way back to the Giuliani administration. Has the pressure to keep the minor crime numbers up, the stop and frisks up, but the reported major crimes down become more intense in recent years? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. And you don't have to use your own name, police officers. How about this? Since the police commissioner is Ray Kelly, why don't you just all call as Kelly? You're Kelly from Brooklyn. You're Kelly from Staten Island. Whoever you are, call in and identify yourself as a police officer named Kelly, and we'll put you on the air. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692, if you care to. And it's almost an open secret that police departments have quotas, Graham. Paul Brown, NYPD spokesperson, denied again in March that they do. They say they have targets, which we can talk about that distinction. But I want to play another clip from the recordings that may surprise people as to how explicit the targets may be.
If I was on patrol, I would be sure to get 3 seatbelts, 1 cell phone, and then the 11 others or whatever the number is, I would try to, you know, get my activity up.
So that's pretty explicit.
Yeah, I mean, what the tapes prove finally once and for all is that there are quotas, and that the officers were threatened with disciplinary action if they didn't make their quotas, which gets into an area of some conflict between the union and the police department.
So the difference between a target and a quota is if there is disciplinary action associated with not meeting a target, then it is a quota. So it becomes sort of show me the numbers or else.
Exactly. And that wasn't just one roll call. It was repeated. In fact, they spent more time in the roll calls demanding activity, quote-unquote activity, than anything else.
This was actually a sergeant at roll call saying, if I was on patrol, I would be sure to get 3 seatbelts, 1 cell phone, and 11 others. He's saying that off the record, or was he saying that on the floor to the officers about to go out on patrol?
Yes. He's ordering them to make the quota. It's a lieutenant, actually. This was on June 12th of 08. It's mm-hmm. a lieutenant, and he's standing in front of officers in ranks. They're also standing, and he's telling them, if I were you, I would make sure to get those numbers.
Yes. Here's a slightly longer clip. This is about 40 seconds, and I think this is Deputy Inspector Stephen Moriello, the only officer you actually name in the articles, and this will give you a sense of the kind of pressure at each level within the NYPD.
There's more accountability. There's less people. They got this catchphrase, do more with less, all right? And, you know, in that regard, they're looking at numbers. Like the inspector said, they're coming to him. The inspector's coming to me. I'm going to the sergeant. And, you know, unfortunately, at this level in your career, you're on the lowest level. So, you know, you're going to get, some orders that you may not like. You're going to get instructions. You're going to get disciplinary action, whatever. You know, you got to just pick up your work because, like he said, I don't want to hurt you. The sergeant doesn't want to hurt you. But, you know, I don't want to get my ass chewed out.
So everything rolls downhill.
Yeah, I just wanted to say that was actually a lieutenant. That wasn't the precinct commander.
Okay.
But yeah, it basically, the precinct commander.
So that was not Moriello.
No, that wasn't.
Okay,
no.
Just to be clear about that.
Yeah, but what's happening is that Moriello is under pressure from his superiors for numbers. His superiors are looking at each individual officer's activity. So he is then turning to his lieutenants and sergeants saying, I want numbers. And then lieutenants and sergeants are passing it on to the patrol officers.
Here is a police officer calling in who wants to say the quotas may be a little bit more complex than we're painting them, I think. Howard in the Bronx, thank you very much for calling. How you doing?
Yeah, how's it going?
So what are you thinking about all this?
No, I mean, like you were talking about the crime statistics and whether the decline in crime can be believed. You know, you have the chief medical office that verifies all homicides, and that all coincides with the police statistics going down.
You can't make up a drop in murder rate, that's for sure.
You know, and then as for the quota issue, they do exist, but the other side is, how do you get people to not go out and just do the Barney wave and drive by and not either interact with the public, not look for crime, not do anything else? So he kind of did that. And as for the guy who got EDP'd from the 8-1, he was EDP'd for what I understand from the newspapers, but he was admitted. And I think he did like a couple of days in the psych ward. And again, you know, that's someone independently verifying that the guy did have some whatever personality or psychological issues and everything else.
Right. Though, I don't know. So you say, or so there may be this documentation, although I guess we have to separate the whistleblower from the materials that he brought forth.
But you also have to wonder, is the whistleblower is putting the material he brought forth for his own personal agenda, and how much did he edit it in terms of, or censor it? You know, how much did he record certain things and not record other things, and how much context is provided?
All good questions, Graham.
The bulk of the most important stuff he gave me that I used for these stories were 117 roll calls, and those roll calls are complete. There's no editing and they exist separate and apart from Mr. Schoolcraft himself, and they're just. They are what they are, basically.
And Howard, unless you want to say anything else, I'm going to let you go, and I really appreciate you chiming in.
I've been to thousands of roll calls, and the vast majority of them, very little is said at. You know, so that's the other context. You know, and again, you know, is there a reality in terms of quotas? Yeah, but then the other issue is, how do you measure productivity and everything else?
No.
You know, doctors, stuff is looked at with doctors, with number of patients they see and other stuff, similar to nurses. There has to be a way of measuring productivity and everything else.
Thank you.
Now, if you can come up with something better, let's hear it.
Thank you for your call and thank you for your service. And Graham, he's got a point about measuring in some way, right?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely, he does. And the question is, how does a patrol officer deal with that pressure? Does he just go out and stop and frisk people for just to make the quota? If he's doing that, then he's bending, if not breaking, rules.
And I guess where the question really comes is, if there's a disconnect between the quota on activity, the minimum amount that he's supposed to do, and a lack in reduction of crime, right? If doing all this broken window stuff, that is, all these arrests for small things, mm-hmm. or at least all these stops, mm-hmm. Is supposed to drive down the numbers of serious crimes. Mm-hmm. If it actually has that effect, it's one thing, and people may dispute that it still may be too aggressive on the street. Well, but if it actually drives down the crime, it's one thing. If it's not really driving it down as much as they say, and they're having to downgrade serious crimes to other things because they don't want to have those reports on paper, then that's really where the problem comes in, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, if you look at the 81st Precinct, in 2004 there were 774 stop and frisks. In 2009, there were 8,108 stop and frisk. That's an increase of almost 900%. And so then you would expect to see a corresponding decline in crime if that campaign was effective. However, this year, crime is actually up slightly in the 81st Precinct, and homicides have increased by about double of what they were last year. So the question is, how effective was that campaign? And the other question is, what's driving all those stop and frisks? Is it the demand for numbers from police headquarters, or is it the perception that there are that many more suspicious people walking around Bed-Stuy today?
Brian Lehrer, WNYC. We're talking with Village Voice investigative reporter Graham Raymond. He has reported a three-part series. The final part will be in this Wednesday's Voice, based on tape recordings. Oh, it's not.
No, it'll be in a couple of weeks.
It'll be in a couple of weeks. Yeah. Okay, but series in progress based on tape recordings made by an actual officer in the 81st Precinct in Bedford-Stuyvesant, raising questions about whether officers are under pressure from above to stop and frisk more, but to avoid felony charges, to keep crime stats looking low. And let's take a phone call from the neighborhood in question here. Here's Cassius in Bedford-Stuyvesant. Cassius, thanks for calling. You're on WNYC.
Hi, Brian. Thank you. I live in the confines of the precinct right next to this one, so I'm in the 7-9 precinct area.
Okay.
And I wanted to thank the writer for pointing out that at the end of each month, that's when the cops really have to rush to get all their quotas filled, and so it's smart to like stay away from cops at the end of each month. And also, the other part of the article that is moving away from the quota question is that he really writes about how all the precincts are so underfunded these days that they, you know, in his article he mentions where there was one day where they couldn't even send a single squad car out to patrol in the precinct area. There wasn't a squad car available. And I've talked with the cops here in my own area, at the 7-9 precinct, and they've told me how there's some nights there's only one squad car for this whole section of Bed-Stuy because of budget cuts, and it's really horrible.
Cassius, thank you for your call. And on that point, how do the budgetary restrictions affect the pressure on the officers? The last piece of tape that we played did also touch on the fact that there are fewer cops charged with doing more work.
Yeah, well, they actually mentioned one of Mayor Bloomberg's favorite catchphrases, "Do more with less," in the precinct, and it was even posted in a sign on the door. And so what was happening was the officers were under pressure to get numbers. Meanwhile, there were a declining number of officers in the precinct, to the point that the precinct is divided into 10 sectors. There might only be two sector cars for the whole precinct in a given day tour. And the sergeants and lieutenants were pulling their hair out over the shortage. They didn't know what to do. And so what they would just basically hope and pray that nothing really big went down on that tour.
Where does stop and frisk come into it? And I want to cite some stats that I guess are from your article. There was an 800% increase in the 81st precinct in Bedford-Stuyvesant in stop and frisks in the last 6 years. 575,000 people were stopped and frisked in 2009. That's a citywide number, I think, right?
Yes.
90% were black or Hispanic citywide, and only 6% of those stops result in arrest. Paul Brown, the NYPD spokesman, explains the numbers by saying that there's a spike in stop and frisk after a crime because so many people meet these vague descriptions of the perps. But are you seeing something else in these tapes? Is there a quota for stop and frisks?
Well, actually, the most common explanation for a stop and frisk is something called furtive movement, which is a very vague category. That's the most common. And the least common is only in about 15% of the stops is the person fit the description of a suspect. So Mr. Brown's assertion there is not quite accurate. Most of the time, people are being stopped for furtive movements. And no one really understands what that means. And what the tapes tell me is that the reason for this explosion in stop and frisks is simply that they're being told to do stop and frisks, not necessarily related to a specific crime. You know, and so if there's a quote in the tapes, this is from March 13th of 09, and a sergeant is telling the officers to do 250s, and he says, "How hard is a 250? I'm not saying make it up, but you can always articulate robbery, burglary, whatever the case may be. It's still a number. It keeps the hounds off."
So it keeps the hounds off means it keeps the brass from coming down on the precinct commanders and the cops in the precinct. But do you learn from this that there's been a change in the way stop and frisk is supervised? Are we seeing more stop and frisks last year than in previous years because somebody at the top made the decision that they should go out and frisk more people? Is that a policy decision? And if so, what is it supposed to accomplish?
Well, I think if the commissioner were here, he would say that stop and frisk is an effective enforcement tool, that you're going out, you're interacting with civilians. You're seeing, and they have said that they have seized over 700 guns in the course of doing these 575,000 stop and frisks.
Let's get one more call from Bed-Stuy in here. Chris, you're on WNYC. Thanks for calling.
Hey, I'm here. Thanks, Brian, for taking my call. I do live in Bed-Stuy in the 7-9 precinct, as well as the previous caller. And the idea of The stop and frisk, to me, is ridiculous when they should stop and talk to the people. In Bed-Stuy, these fellas stand on corner. They're in public doing what they do. Everybody who lives here knows exactly what's going on in the corner. They know exactly which bodega is selling drugs, and they know exactly who's involved. And the police drive by with their windows rolled up or walk by, and they don't take the chance to even engage these guys who are standing out there all the time. And when they do stop and frisk, the idea that they're interacting with the community is ridiculous. What they're doing is they're putting them on notice that they are treating them like criminals, which is the prevailing attitude in the relationship between the people of this neighborhood and the police.
Now, I've asked police officials about things like this, and they say, well, really, stop and frisk is a misnomer, because first they stop and do talk, and not everybody who stopped actually gets frisked. There has to be another level of suspicion in order to actually frisk somebody who stopped. But your experience is that they're not really doing that much.
When they stop and frisk, they often speed up in the car and they jump out as if something is amiss already. And I assure you, something is amiss. Let's not be fools here. They are dealing drugs on the corner openly to people, and everybody knows it. And the police feel like their hands are tied in terms of what are the legalities of making a case against these guys. But in a community, the fallout from their existence on these corners is tremendous, and they are a vast minority of people who are engaged in this activity, and for whatever reason the police have not been able to figure out how to deal with these guys because they are in some way so protected by deep family connections within the community. I would suggest that if they got out of the cars more often, and when they did stroll up the street, they stopped and talked to these guys every day, as in, hey, how are you doing? What's going on today? Mm-hmm. A simple conversation just to make sure that these guys know that they know they're there and that they have an idea of what's going on, and to treat them in a more humanistic way may lower the tension level between the police and the people in the community,
Chris,
especially those who are innocent, which is the vast majority of people who live here of any crime whatsoever.
Thank you very much for your call. And, Graham, before you go, since Officer Schoolcraft blew the whistle, that is, released these tapes, crime in the 81st precinct jumped by 13%, 76% jump in felony assaults from the stats that I've seen. So we can assume that these crimes are no longer being downgraded? Can we assume that? Can we assume that now that this is out in the open, there's more pressure to report crimes, or that this is somehow backfired and crime is actually going up because, you know, cops feel more alienated than ever?
Well, I think the 76% jump in felony assaults when the citywide increase was only 4% is a big I don't have the access to the files of those cases, but that tells me that there was something strange going on there.
All right, Graham Raymond, Village Voice, investigative reporter, using these tapes released by NYPD Officer Adrian Schoolcraft from the 81st Precinct in Bedford-Stuyvesant for his three-part series in the Village Voice. When's part three?
In a couple weeks.
Okay. Graham, thank you very much.
Thanks a lot.
Brian Lehrer in WNYC. And still to come, one successful businesswoman's take on revamping your company for the post-bubble era. And then we'll talk about law and order moving to Los Angeles. Can you believe it? Stay with us.